Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. On our show this week, Lori talks to Corinna Longworth, who hosts a podcast that I just love called You Must Remember This, about the highways and byways of obscure Hollywood history. Colin Marshall, founder of the LARB podcast, stops by to talk to us about relocating to Korea. Apparently, Koreatown was not far enough. Tom, he had to move to Seoul. What is that about?
Seoul, of course, is the, I think half the people in Korea live in Seoul. It's a, is the city. He's going to be reporting back to us. You know, there are these big rallies in the streets, anti-government rallies. 50 people were arrested. And
the rumor is they're not really anti-government.
You think it's anti-Colin?
That's what I'm hearing.
I heard that too.
Could be.
And Dana Johnson is here with a book recommendation. So stick around and find out what she's got up her sleeve. Joining me are my usual co-conspirators. She is an editor. She is a critic. She is the fiction editor of LARB. You know her as Lori Weiner. Hello, Lori.
Hi, Seth.
And he is a professor at UC Riverside, an author of several books, and the founding editor of LARB, Tom Lutz. Hello, Tom.
Seth, it is good to be here.
Where exactly are we, Tom?
Well,
I'm a little disoriented.
It's funny you should ask. We are now at Emerson College, Los Angeles, where we are taping in the state-of-the-art facilities.
It's a lovely place.
It's fantastic.
It doesn't feel like a storage closet. I'm a little disoriented, not seeing any mops in the corner.
And all of the equipment works. It's a whole new world for us.
So now it's only our fault if it... Yeah, screws up.
It's certainly not Emerson College, LA's.
All right, let's do the show.
I am sitting here with Corinna Longworth, whose work I've really been admiring a lot. She does a podcast called You Must Remember This, which is a good name for a podcast because it's difficult to forget. And I noticed that I was hearing about your work from young women in their 20s and 30s. And this, I realized later that this is a pattern. A young woman told me about that she was listening to the podcast on Charles Manson. This is one of Corinna's most ambitious, You Must Remember This, shows. It's 12 parts on Charles Manson. You connect what's happening in popular culture, in indie culture, in music, in drug culture. And we get this picture of the Manson family as part of this enormous tapestry. This was the first show that you did a 12-part series on. When did you discover it was going to need to be that long?
I had done a lot of two-part stories, and then I had done a series called Star Wars, where I did maybe 16 or 17 episodes about the experiences of movie stars during World War II. After I did the Star Wars series, I knew that it was easier for me if I approached a chunk of episodes that all took place around the same period of time and that were related to the same ideas. So I knew that I wanted to do something about Charles Manson. And that started with me basically finding out about Terry Melcher, who was a character I had never heard of before. And he was Doris Day's son. He was a record producer. And he believed that when Charles Manson's family went to CLO Drive that night and killed Sharon Tate and her friends, Terry Melcher believed that they were looking for him. And so when I found out about that and found out more about Doris Day's life that was not publicized very well, was not really a part of her star persona, I realized that there's got to be more stories here where people have these tangential relationships to Charles Manson that could tell you something not just about Manson and that period, but about Hollywood and really the way that stories are told about these things.
And one of the things that occurs again and again in your podcasts without underlining it, it just naturally happens, is the treatment of women throughout the century. One of your latest episodes, we'll go back to the Manson, but one of your latest episodes was about a fixer named Eddie Mannix. Mm-hmm. the chief story that comes out of that is the story of Patricia Douglas. Can you just briefly tell the story?
That part of the podcast is very much in debt to a historian named David Sten, who uncovered this story and wrote an article in Vanity Fair and made a documentary about it. But Patricia Douglas was a young girl who was sort of on the fringes of the industry. She had worked as a dancer, but like hadn't achieved anything like notoriety or stardom. And she was one of 200 girls hired to appear at an MGM party that the studio threw for its salesmen from around the country, people who booked the movies into movie theaters and stuff like that. All of the invited guests at the party were men, and there was an enormous amount of alcohol provided, and it had a Wild West theme. So all of the hired girls were wearing skimpy cowgirl outfits. And it was not stated that the women were hired to be escorts for the men, but it was heavily implied, and that's the way that they were treated by a lot of the men. And this young woman, Patricia Douglas, was raped by a MGM salesman from Chicago. And this was probably not the first time that a studio employee had forced a woman to have sex with him against their will, but it was the first time that the woman used the courts to try to draw attention to it. And she filed several lawsuits against the specific man and also other members of the MGM staff, including Eddie Mannix. And all of the lawsuits basically fell apart, partially due to MGM's connections with the district attorney and other political factors.
And from the beginning to the end of the story, which is a really horrific story, this woman was manipulated and used without her knowledge or consent at the beginning because she thinks that she's auditioning for a role. She doesn't even know she's auditioning for a girl at a party.
Yeah, all of the women thought that they were going to be background dancers in a movie scene.
And then when she does get raped and she tries to take her case to court, she finds out that the district attorney and Louis B. Mayer are, in fact, in each other's pockets.
Yeah, Louis B. Mayer was, I think, the biggest donor to the district attorney's campaign.
There's a woman being beaten up in, you know, almost every story. You're very matter-of-fact about it. You're not dramatic about it. But the fact that you feel the need to mention it in every story, you're telling the history in a fresh way, you know, I think.
Right. Certainly the way that these stories were told in the time that they were happening, even though there were female gossip columnists, generally these things were being told from the point of view of men who were going to be reading. And a woman like Ingrid Bergman could have like an infidelity scandal, but Sheila Graham, the gossip columnist, she said, like, my bosses told me not to report on the affairs of married men because it was classless. You know, the perspective of culture has changed. Now there's a multitude of voices who are able to speak and also to hear. And so the, you know, the secret and or forgotten thing, it's kind of a joke. Like, I mean, a lot of my podcast in terms of the way it's framed is a little bit tongue in cheek. But I do feel like it, in keeping a focus on trying to figure out what it was like to be a woman in these situations, I am kind of telling a version of the story that hasn't been told.
Going back to Charles Manson, one of the things you connect is the indie filmmaker, the underground filmmaker, Kenneth Anger, to the most well-known filmmakers of the time, like Warren Beatty. And Kenneth Anger is a fan of Aleister Crowley, and there is some flirting with Satan worship in that culture. And I thought it was interesting that over here, they're playing with Satan stuff. And then when the Manson murders happen, it does seem as if it's a personification of Satan's work on earth. I mean, it's hard to imagine a more horrible, you know, event.
But I think that maybe the idea that Manson and his clan were Satan worshippers is a misconception, or, you know, I think it's something a lot of people have, but it's maybe a conflation of things that were in the air, where in fact, like, Manson was telling people he was Jesus.
Right. But as you show in your series, there's a component over here that is playing with Satan worship, and that Warren Beatty is making Bonnie and Clyde, which is such an remarkably violent mainstream film, was very shocking in its time. And then Charles Manson telling Tex Watson to make it look like the most violent, horrible thing you've ever seen when he had never, as you point out, he had never seen a murder. So that would refer to a movie.
Well, I assume so. I mean, there's nothing that I've read that says that they had a conversation about Bonnie and Clyde. But I just think about most people who have not seen a crime scene in real life. And especially at that time, Bonnie and Clyde was a new thing. Movies, mainstream movies had never been that violent before. You'd never seen that much bright red blood. And it just felt to me like there had to be some kind of connection between Charlie Manson saying, make it as bad as anything you've ever seen, and what would have Tex seen.
Your series actually does give a very, let's not say concrete, but a very cohesive theory about how it happened, because it's the kind of event that people look at and say, I could never in a gazillion years understand this. And when you bring in all of these cultural forces, you actually make it understandable. Were you trying to understand how it could happen yourself?
I don't think that that's a literal question that I ask myself, but for me, I was born in 1980, so all of this stuff happened quite a bit before I was born, and so it's actual history for me. And so I'm approaching, not just with the Charles Manson stuff, but with almost everything that I do on the podcast, I'm really trying to figure out what it was like to be alive during this time and what it would have felt like to be these people who are involved in these things.
This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner. You are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles. Let's go back to Lori's interview with Corinna Longworth.
I think another reason that you might be a feminist heroine to young women is because of the way that you have made your own career in this very difficult climate of journalism being practically obliterated. You came up as a blogger about film, and you did it so well that you were noticed and then hired by the LA Weekly. I know I'm simplifying the career, but and then you began to feel, and correct me if I'm misstating, I just read an interview with you, but you began to feel limited by daily criticism, which can be a real grind. Mm-hmm. And you felt that you had to have opinions about things that you didn't necessarily have strong opinions about, and you wanted to report on what interested you. Mm-hmm. And so you found a way to do that with this podcast.
Well, there was a gap between when I quit my job. The last thing I did for the LA Weekly was in January 2013, and I didn't start the podcast until April 2014. So there was almost a year and a half where I was trying to figure things out. And I did work that entire time. I did freelance work for places like Grantland and Slate. And I finished a book and wrote an entire other book. And I taught for a semester. But I knew all of those things were things that had been commissioned by other people, or the teaching job was something where I took it over for a friend who was leaving town and was not a great fit for me. And it was actually during that time where I was like, I can't keep going like this. I need to figure out something to do that I'm passionate about. So I used it sounds crazy when I say it, but I'd heard the podcast in my head. Like, I knew what it sounded like. So when I had a spring break from teaching, I was like, I'm going to spend 10 days figuring out how to make that thing I hear in my head. But I can't say that it was like this internal drive that was just like, well, I'm going to quit my job and make a podcast. There was definitely months where I wasn't sure what I was supposed to be doing. And, I'm in a relationship with somebody who also doesn't go to an office every day and is a creative person. But he's somebody who writes and directs movies and is never going to do anything but writing and directing movies. Whereas for me, all I know is that I like old movies and I want to learn more about them. And that can take many different forms.
Do you want to just say briefly about what book you're working on?
Sure, yeah. I'm writing a book for a new imprint called Custom House. It's part of HarperCollins. And the book is going to be about Howard Hughes and his time in Hollywood and the women in his life, the actresses that he dated or was in some way linked to. And it's going to kind of use all of that as a lens to talk about, basically what my podcast does is what it was like to be a woman in this place in this time. And the thing that's fascinating about Howard Hughes to me is not even so much that he reportedly had relationships with so many famous people. It's that he is like a Zelig character in a different way, in that he shows up in Hollywood in 1925. He's present and participating in the transition from silent film to sound film. Then with the first Scarface, he has a major fight with the censors. He continues to have fights like that with the film The Outlaw that he directed and made Jane Russell a star in. And then he is involved with the Blacklist. He takes over RKO Studios and runs it into the ground. And then he disappears into a hotel in Las Vegas. So the major flashpoints of the golden era of Hollywood, like Howard Hughes is present and involved in and sort of doing almost like a comical version of, because he comes at everything as an independent, as like this cowboy with all this money and doing things his own way. And he just sort of bumbles his way through it.
Karina's podcast is called You Must Remember This. That's what it's called. I'm not telling you to remember it. It's called You Must Remember This. And it's terrific. Check it out.
Thank you.
The author Dana Johnson has graciously agreed to come back and tell us about a book she thinks we all should be reading. Welcome back, Dana.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
So what's this book?
I love a book called The Little Brother by Victoria Patterson, and it's a book that explores the relationship between two brothers, and one brother is involved in a sexual assault, and so his little brother has to figure out what to do about that. And it's based on an actual case, the Heidel case in Orange County. I forget what year.
2002.
Okay. So the book, I think, is an important book because in the media, we're often talking about these cases. They seem to be publicized more and more, sexual assaults in college, date rape. But what Victoria Patterson's book is doing is asking us to examine all the ways in which our culture informs these assaults. And so I love it because she's talking about privilege, she's talking about class, she's talking about masculinity and the culture that we live in, which encourages young men to be as sexual as possible. It's just a very smart book. And I think political in ways that I wish more contemporary books were, just very frankly talking about the politics of the body, the politics of race, the politics of class. All of her books do that, really.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this book explores those subject matters even more deeply.
Well, Tori, of course, we're very proud of that. She's a graduate of the UC Riverside MFA program, and she's become the kind of bard of Newport Beach, right? Because her first, This Fake in Paradise, the first novel.
Yeah, and I love it too, because I feel like she's a truth teller and she's not afraid to piss people off, but she also has a love of the place too. That's where she grew up, and Newport Beach is beautiful, but things can be more than one thing at once. And I think she's really good at detailing the complications of place.
The book is The Little Brother. The author is Victoria Patterson. Dana Johnson, thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner. You are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 KPFK, Los Angeles. Colin Marshall is a writer, an expert on the subject of cities, and the original voice of LARB. Colin did the original LARB podcast, Tom.
He was the podcast guy. He has been the podcast guy for years now.
He is in the position right now of being about to semi-expatriate. We'll ask him about that. And he's come to say goodbye. Welcome, Colin Marshall.
Thank you. Hello and goodbye, but hello first.
Are you leaving just to disassociate with the LARB Radio Hour?
Of course. I'm sad that I'm leaving when you started it. You just moved into this beautiful office too. It seems like exactly the wrong time to go.
Well, you'll come back.
So, Colin, where have you decided to go?
I'm going to Seoul, Korea. And you know, the long-term goal is Los Angeles for me is too interesting to stay out of. So I want to have a foot both here and there, but that's going to require a few steps. I want to get dual citizenship after living in Korea a few years, do some more studying of the language. So it's all a long process that should ultimately involve me flying back and forth a whole lot. So we'll see how that goes.
Are you going to be doing any radio there?
Probably do some Korean language stuff there. There's also a big robust English language radio world there that I know a lot of people in. So we'll see what I fall into. You know, there's lots of people have work visas I could potentially make use of. So we'll see. We'll see.
And you're going to send us back a podcast now and then in English.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's writers like, if you're a listener to the podcast, if you have been, I interviewed Chris Lee, the well-known Korean-American writer, or she's just purely multinational, I think.
She's Korean-American now. Right.
Yeah, in Korea. Now, she was in Rome. I saw her on Facebook. She'd been there for a while. So she's a global human of the 21st century. But I talked to her when I was in Korea last summer for the LARB. And there'll be more such people, of course, more English-speaking Korean writers and other Korea resident writers.
And we're going to set you up with a Korea blog on the LARB blog. Yeah, right?
The freshly minted idea of the Korea blog. I'm jazzed about it. I think this is Los Angeles is the most Korean city outside Korea itself. I think we need this, don't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there'll be Korean academics in Korean studies around the country and in Korea, obviously.
I'm looking forward to reading this myself.
Me too. Yeah, I'm very excited about it.
In the Western media, Seoul seems to get very little love compared to the other Asian capitals. I'm thinking of Tokyo, Hong Kong. What's drawing you to Seoul?
Seoul is, it's just a place where the idea of the city is taken very, very seriously. You know, a big part of what I like about Los Angeles is in recent years, it's really started to become aware of itself as a city. People have started to have a sense of Los Angeles as a city. You know, the term real city is very loaded around here. There's arguments about whether Los Angeles is or is not a real city, but one reason I don't want to keep both feet out of Los Angeles now, I want to keep a foot in it, is because of that transformation. You know, one of the things that I'm not going to miss about America is we don't take our cities all that seriously on the whole. There's the sense that they're bad places, they're places to be avoided, they're places where the crime is done to you. But in Seoul, as I say, half the population lives there. It is regarded as the place. It's the place to be. Cities are the places to be in a country like Korea. You know, there's a reason why all the buildings are 30 stories minimum, why the transit system is so robustly built and so on. It's just, it's a place, it's a city sort of uncompromised, shall we say. The perfect expression of a city.
Colin, where are you from?
I grew up around Seattle, but I was born in Northern California.
Mm-hmm. So, and have you lived on the East Coast?
No, not at all. Uh-huh. I have not.
So you don't know New York very well?
No, my knowledge is pretty sketchy of New York. Yeah, I've never even spent the night there. I've set foot there. But my awareness is like Los Angeles's awareness of Asia and of Latin America, primarily. It's not necessarily a Europe. It's focused awareness I have, which is why I like Los Angeles.
Yeah. And when I was in Seoul, the thing that struck me immediately, because you get into the airport and you're deep into the 21st century.
Yes, right? Of course.
It's a gleaming, unbelievable structure. And then you walk looking for the subway, and the subway bursts into the airport itself.
Right, the train's right there.
Big tube. Like the front of a Boeing 747 or 67 or whichever the biggest one is. It's just this huge gleaming stainless steel thing. And then you get on the subway right in the airport, and there are TV screens every 3 feet on the subway, and it is perfectly clean. And it's just the infrastructure is beyond anything I've ever seen.
The seats are heated in the subway. They have heated seats in the subway.
For your average American traveler who would go to Shanghai or Beijing or Tokyo, is Seoul a welcoming city?
It is welcoming in a way. I feel like the people there, and Tom, feel free to chime in with your experience, but the people are quite welcoming to foreigners. They want to project an image of Korea as an international country, and that involves a lot of interaction with foreigners. I mean, I've studied the Korean language a while, so I communicate as best I can in it, but if you're speaking English there, I mean, there's probably going to be some bumps here and there, but I feel like it's a country that wants to open itself, and there's a sense that it's not like, I mean, Japan is a bit more turned into itself for better or for worse. It's a more insular place. Korea is still 98.5% Korean, something like that. And China has a different set of difficulties, but Korea's kind of, it strikes a balance where it is developing very rapidly like China. It's looking outward in a more effective way than Japan is. So geographically, it's what you would expect it to be. It's has what I would consider the exciting qualities of China with a few of the exciting qualities of Japan as well. Sort of the sensibility or the way the society works is impressive, especially to an American.
Yeah, but I mean, people, there are countries that I've been to where there's a hospitality culture and you walk into a little town and people come out and greet you and say hello. And I did not get that in Korea. No,
it's not
gregarious in that way. But if you're in a restaurant or you're in a shop, people are bend over backwards to be polite and to greet you.
There is this, I mean, within even among Koreans themselves, there's this sense that a stranger, another Korean you don't know, is not a human being, really. So you can just bump them. You don't have to apologize, do anything. But anybody you have even the least connection to, and my example is always somebody who was a year above you in school, you might not have known them, but you know, if you meet them on the street, you'll fall to your knees and just, you'll treat them like a god. The least connection equals just this degree of generosity. It's hard to imagine here. Whereas if there's no connection, there's really, I mean, they might as well be a brick or something, you know?
Have you eaten a lot of Korean food in Los Angeles?
I live in Koreatown, so answer is okay. Every day. Yes, yes, yes.
So, and is there any international cooking in South Korea, or is it pretty much all Korean cooking?
I'll tell you this. I make a point just to torture myself of eating Mexican food in foreign countries. And Tom, I think you can speak to this. Outside of Mexico itself, point south, some, not too far south, and Southern California, Mexican food is not, it's not easy to come by in a form we recognize. And yet Mexican food still has a way to go in Seoul, for sure. It's getting there. But they have Ethiopian food that can hold its own. They have a lot of Chinese food. There's Korean Chinese food, which is a distinct genre of Chinese food, kind of like American Chinese food, has its own dishes, not really known to Chinese people. There's a few Korean Chinese restaurants in Koreatown here, in fact, but Seoul is not the most international city of them all, it's true, but increasingly you can get bigger and bigger chunks of the outside world there, mostly in this neighborhood, Itaewon, which is where the military base is, the U.S. military base. A neighborhood I find kind of gross and a bit too foreigner-centric, but if you want Ethiopian food, that's where you're going to be able to find it in Seoul.
And do you know what neighborhood you're going to live in when you get there?
Well, there's a lot of ones I like, but you know what we've all heard the song Gangnam Style. I want to live in the other part of Seoul. Gangnam literally means south of the river. Think of the River Thames in London. It's the same thing, the Han River. It cuts through the middle. South of the river is Gangnam. North of the river is Gangbuk. North is the older city. South is the newer one. The north part, the old part, has cooler things. It's a little, quite a bit less wealthy, but it has a wider variety of sort of cultural offerings and sort of more architectural variety. Think of East Side and West Side Los Angeles. I won't say which side I think accords to which one in Seoul, but I think we all know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, a little Rive Gauche.
Sure. Yeah.
And so we look forward to the Korea blog. We look forward to your podcast from Korea. And thanks so much for coming in and talking to us today.
I look forward to doing them. Thank you.
Thanks to Colin Marshall, Karina Longworth, Dana Johnson. Thanks to Emerson College for hosting us in this beautiful new space. Our thanks to our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorham, our crack production assistant, Ernesto Aureliano, czar of scheduling, Aviva de Kornfeld, still recovering nicely from being bitten by BJ Novak's monkey more than 2 weeks ago now.
That wasn't funny.
And of course, the irreplaceable Sid Biggs. We couldn't do this without him. Find us on the web at www.lareviewofbooks.org. Download us on iTunes. Better yet, give us a rating. We like 5 stars. Write a review if you want, something that begins with, "I love the LARB Radio Hour so much that you can fill out the rest." For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, this is Seth Greenland. Thanks for listening.